Hello, welcome to the Science for Policy podcast. My name is Toby, and today I'm joined by Dr. Eleni Zika. Dr. Zika was first trained in molecular biology and genetics before she developed a career in research program management. She's now the head of the European Research Council's new team focused on scientific impact and feedback to policy. So, Eleni, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Toby. Nice to be with you.
Very happy to have you. Just for those of us who are not completely up to speed, because I know some listeners from this podcast are not from Europe, perhaps you could explain in a few words what the European Research Council is and how it fits into the broader research landscape of Europe. I mean, we know the EU has this absolutely colossal research funding program called Horizon Europe, which funds projects directly. Why is there also a European Research Council, which also funds research?
Well, I mean, it was an idea that was born from scientists directly, actually, many years back, as there was clearly a need to fund with substantial investments, extraordinary ideas that were pushing the frontiers of science and technology. And back in 2007, when the ERC was funded, actually, there was a real gap at the time for investments of research that were really pushing the frontiers of science and were really giving enough resources to investigators to freely research topics of their own interest without any constraints or without any predetermined topics. So the ERC was born from this idea that we need to give enough independence and freedom to researchers to pursue their ideas. And they were basically decided to select those only on the basis of scientific excellence. And I think that's what also sets the ERC apart from other funding programs, both in Europe and in other parts of the world. The fact that the selection is based only on scientific excellence, the excellence of the idea, but the excellence also of the principal investigator. And since then, actually, it has funded more than 10,000 independent investigators that are not part of consortia or multi-partner partnerships, as is the case for other programs. So it has been quite a success story, in fact, since 2007, and it now really is recognized as the top funder in Europe, but also internationally. So it is really wonderful to see it bloom in this way and clearly fulfill its mission.
Yes, so it does sound very different from other funding programs like Horizon Europe, which tend to be quite strategic and, you know, aligned with existing goals. Whereas it sounds like at the ERC, it doesn't so much matter what you do as long as you're good at what you do.
Absolutely. We are part of Horizon Europe. I mean, the funding does come from the framework program, as has been the case since FP7, in fact, when the ERC was born. But it is only focused on excellent science. So, and indeed, what sets it apart is the fact that, you know, the money is given to independent investigators, PI-driven projects, who have complete freedom and agility to pursue what they think is excellent science that is really also at boundaries or across boundaries among disciplines and fields. So I think, yeah, the uniqueness is really in the fact that there is no predetermined topics or priorities that they should address. They just come in and compete with their ideas.
So if it's not a stupid question, why is this a good thing? I mean, it's all very well to say to researchers, go and play and pursue whatever you're interested in. But when we're talking about not inconsiderable amounts of taxpayers' money, actually, shouldn't we prefer it, in fact, to be rather more targeted and try to direct a little bit to get what we need out of the research?
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a good and valid question. It keeps coming back. We would never have any vaccines, vaccines for COVID in particular, just to make a recent example out of this. If we were not investing in curiosity-driven research, actually, we wouldn't have any knowledge foundation, substantial knowledge foundation, to have solutions for major societal problems.
Well, wait, so we as a society would never have strategically chosen to invest in vaccines. We had to wait for scientists to think of that themselves.
Well, that's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that, of course, you need to, of course, society needs to invest in strategic questions and taxpayers' money need to be invested wisely, both in priority-driven research, but also allow enough space for curiosity-driven research to derive and produce the knowledge that we need in order to design solutions for problems that are acute. We often cannot predict what will be the next problem of our planet or our society. So in many ways, what frontier science actually does is to prepare us for that by helping us to understand better the living world. And so if we don't have that foundation in the first place, how can we come up with reasonable solutions, innovations at the right moment and at the right speed? I think this is an important basic foundation. And I mean, of course, the COVID vaccine is just one example. I mean, there's an ERC project, an ERCPI funded that was researching mRNA technologies for a completely different question. But all the work that he invested in, as other partners and colleagues and other researchers in the world, actually helped drive the development of the COVID vaccine in a very fast way. In a very fast turnaround at the moment that was critical for society. So I guess what science, we have to allow science to, you know, run its course, and we have to allow scientists to dream big and to explore questions that may often seem unexplorable or uninteresting, but we can never predict what that could be useful for. And I think there has to be enough space for that to happen.
All right. Well, I mean, this is the reason I asked that question. As I understand it, this is still a pragmatic justification, isn't it? I mean, we're saying that targeting all our research funding at the challenges we already know about is not the best way to come up with the solutions we need, especially the solutions we don't yet know that we need.
Yes, yes. I mean, if I may, yes, absolutely. That I think this is important. How can we predict today what will be the problem of tomorrow? I mean, we can anticipate, and there's different ways of anticipating, you know, doing horizon scanning, future exercises, etc. But if people didn't experiment, you know, if Pasteur wasn't trying things out, we wouldn't have antibiotics today, if I can put it that way, you know, and that was purely curiosity-driven experimentation. And oftentimes we need to explain to our society, I believe, and our friends, our family members, our citizens, about the usefulness of that seemingly unuseful research.
And that's an argument you can make to policymakers.
Yeah. Frontier science may look entirely useless at first sight. You know, for many politicians, you know, it's like, why are you studying, you know, the impact of math on musical theory? I can give you many reasons, huh? But this is what we're trying to really get at.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear. But this is why I mentioned that your answer to the question is still a pragmatic one, you know. And I can see, I mean, someone who also works with policymakers myself sometimes, I can see that your answer is a convincing one. I mean, you may think it's useless, but actually without that kind of research, we would not have Pasteur's breakthrough or COVID vaccines or, you know, whatever possible breakthrough might come from studying the relationship between maths and music that might save the world tomorrow in a way we don't expect today. But then from another perspective, it's also interesting to me that what you're not saying, the argument you're not making, is that it's not all about utility anyway. You know, there's a different reason for wanting this kind of research to be done, perhaps, even if it turns out always to be useless, never to have any implications for any other part of society. We do it because we, as a community, as a species, we want to know things, even as it turns out, useless things. We want to push the boundaries of human knowledge for their own sake, as a good in itself. Now, I can completely see why that might not be your first go-to argument when you're trying to convince a member of the European Parliament who holds the purse strings for your funding. But I mean, talking more conceptually as we are now, do you think there's any value in making that kind of argument more generally?
Yeah, and also, it's not only the policymaker, you know, it's like I was thinking, talking to a family in France, you know, very well-off educated people who are like, we don't get what you're doing. why are you spending so much money on this and that? You know? And the only way I could actually get through to them was by giving extremely practical examples, which is very sad, you know, because I had a superb example of there's a researcher in Germany or Switzerland, I can't remember exactly. And she was looking at basically human evolution by studying bone findings of a 13-year-old from a million years ago, but she was able actually to identify a new race that gave rise to a new lineage entirely that we were not aware of. And they're like, okay, who cares? And I'm like, let me tell you why it's so important, because when we understand racial development over millions of years of evolution, actually, we can actually understand behaviors in a much more refined way, and design also approaches to cope with behaviors, talk about behaviors, you know, in a more informed manner. So that's really too high level, I think, for some people, you know.
No, it makes sense.
It just doesn't resonate because it's way in the past, you know. But as you say, it's...
Right, yeah, it does make sense. And it's refreshing, I think, to have a major research body saying impact is all very well, but that's not what we're interested in.
Yes, and actually we don't select who we fund on the basis of how useful this would be or could be eventually for society. We really select it on the basis of the excellence, of the innovation, the vision, you know, of this being out there and novel enough and innovative enough to merit funding, and is also excellent in all aspects, but purely from the point of view of curiosity, pushing the frontiers of your own discipline or your own field, or seeing how you can actually go beyond fields, you know, cross fields for your particular project. The societal impact is not at all a criterion in our case. And I think that has been a very refreshing perspective also for the research community, who are actually very keen to participate and compete in ERC calls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm quite sure. I mean, it's a significant amount of money. But it is worth saying also this is only one fairly small part of the EU's overall science budget.
Oh, absolutely. But what I think is very interesting in Europe, and I think what is very encouraging, is that it has become a significant part of it. I think today in Horizon Europe, this represents about 17% of the overall budget, the excellent science pillar. It is, as you say, only a part of it, but I think it's an important foundation for the rest also to happen, in fact. And we do see interesting transcendences and synergies between our program and others. I mean, much of the knowledge that is produced through this the program that ERC implements actually can be taken up or is being taken up by other programs. I can give you the example. We have this scheme called Proof of Concepts, which are actually very interestingly now liaising with the European Innovation Council's accelerator scheme, where you have ERC grantees actually having a fast-track access to be able to scale up some of their innovations and solutions. So there are very intimate connections, but I think the generation of knowledge in itself is a huge asset. And it's a non-rival good. It's a benefit for the society in itself.
A very practical question now. We know that the Science EU Fund does make its way into policy, even if that's not how you choose who to fund. But we also know in general that tracking the impact of this kind of science for policy work is notoriously difficult, I mean, except in a few cases. And I can only imagine that your research, which is not even aimed at policy impact in the first place, must be even harder to measure, to establish that impact for. I mean, you can point to a few shiny examples, like you've already mentioned the COVID-19 vaccine or Pasteur toiling away in his lab. Not that Pasteur was ERC funded, but you know what I mean. But other than just picking on examples, how do you approach this question of measuring impact?
Yes. I mean, yes, we are making an effort to track it at all. We will see. This is work in the making. Because ERC is entirely bottom-up and there's complete freedom given to researchers to bring in excellent projects of their own, it is indeed more difficult to make connections between that and the policy objectives, if you like, or policy developments for many different fields. Another challenge we have in our program is that being entirely bottom-up, it is also extremely diverse. We fund projects from anything related to, you know, archaeology and evolution, all the way up to raw materials, architectural design of buildings, to musical theory, to life sciences. So it's extremely broad. And the impact and relevance is, you know, very, very wide. So we have to devise ways and approaches and tools to help us do that. And the first thing that we do, I must say our ambition is modest. We are in the early stages of trying to do this more systematically in ERC. But as a first step, what we try to do is to find ways to characterize our portfolio of more than 10,000 projects in a systematic manner. First of all, we need to be able to say quickly and reproducibly in a manner where that's pretty robust what we are funding in energy, what we are funding in health, for instance, what we are funding for artificial intelligence, just about any topic. We need to be able to describe and characterize our portfolio. So this is our starting basis. And we have developed an approach that is called Mapping Frontier Science that is based on a classification that our scientific council actually has helped us develop with over 900 terms that cross topics, disciplines, and methods to be able to kind of build portfolio analysis in this systematic manner very quickly. And we have been publishing this kind of mapping of the scientific landscape report since FP7. This taxonomy, of course, is evolving with new terms because science in itself evolves. So we keep that very much up to date. And I think it's quite robust because it is actually done by scientific officers in the agency who have expertise in the portfolios that they, in the respective portfolios they manage. So this is, I think, a huge asset in itself. But beyond that mapping of the scientific landscape, we've started since Horizon 2020 to look at modestly, as I said, possible links to broad policy areas. And we recently published three reports, actually, that looked at the relevance of our portfolio that had been already characterized according to that methodology to the Green Deal, to the EU for Health agenda, and to the digital agenda. And we did that also by tagging, if you like, or describing in a systematic manner the policy links between every single project and certain, you know, any of those three areas. And what we did in order to do that, actually, we used policy terms that are described or were described at the time in the Horizon 2020 Framework Program. So, of course, this is a convention, but that already helped us identify that, you know, more than 30% of our portfolio is related for EU for health policies. More than 14% of our portfolio actually is directly linked to Green Deal policies. And so what we're trying to do now, going beyond that phase of simply descriptive narrative of those links, we're trying to dig deeper into possible relevance and links between policy areas and our projects by focusing on more well-defined concrete topics. So Green Deal, of course, it's everything from farm-to-fork strategy to food security to bioeconomy to what have you. So now, little by little, we try to dig into deeper in specific topics to be able to derive also how results of our projects link to policy objectives. Hopefully also identifying examples where there was a direct impact. We have some, in fact. They are a little bit ad hoc for the moment, but we are trying to make that more systematic. This is actually our goal as a team.
Yeah, and that's the hard part by the sounds of it. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like mapping itself is a challenge just because of the diversity of what you do. But it's one thing to be able to say there are these policy priorities and look, X percent of our research is related to them. It's another thing to be able to point at a specific policy measure or process and say, our project contributed to this in this way.
Yeah.
That's difficult.
But I must say that, of course, our ERC grantees are not working, the PIs we fund are not working in a silo. They work as part of the society, and they are themselves very frequently directly in contact with policymakers because they are, as experts, participating in stakeholder consultations, in policy consultations, in policy design. Some actually do that as part of their bread and butter. That is actually their entire body of research work. It has to do with policy design. What we're trying to do, with my team at least now, is to try to shed more light onto that. And be able to report on that more systematically, because a lot of it is happening already, but we just simply have not been able until now to very systematically talk about it or showcase some of those examples. We hope to, there's plenty in fact, but we're going to try and do more.
Great. So the ERC has created this new team, which you're leading, but I guess that your role is not only to try and evaluate what links there are between science and policy, as it were, by accident. I guess you also have some role to try and promote those links.
Well, we're careful there. I must say that when we were writing up our feedback to policy, from this whole entire activity is described as feedback to policy in our context, and it's actually, if I can become technical a little bit, it is a delegated activity for all implementing bodies that are part of Horizon Europe. Yeah. So this is an obligation we have as an agency, as a program, but not only us, that actually all of Horizon Europe programs need to do this feedback to policy. In the ERC, because we are a bottom-up program, we had to, when we were designing our approach and writing up our framework for how we want to do this, we said clearly we will not be deriving policy recommendations as such. Our role and our focus is going to be on deriving the evidence basis that policymakers need to be informed about whatever decisions and designs they need to be working about for their work. So we're really focusing on that, but we are not going to be producing policy advice. I think that's an important point to make. However, just by doing this work, actually, this interface between science, the evidence basis, and policymakers will certainly be enhanced. But it is not, if you like, our ultimate objective to do that ourselves as a team. Our main goal is to be able to produce that evidence basis in a more systematic manner and in a more informative manner. We are actually exchanging a lot with other partners and other stakeholders within the European Commission as well, like the Joint Research Center, who are as well at this science policy interface very actively contributing to ensure that we do not duplicate efforts and we do not, and we maximize our collaboration, our complementarity. But we do not want to derive policy advice as such. That is not our objective, and I think that is also, if you like, part of our uniqueness as a program.
Yeah, but I'm glad you said that about not duplicating, because this work that you're now describing, in a way, it's not the main way you would expect your research or the research that you fund to make it into policy. So one factor you mentioned is that your grantees anyway might be active in their own countries and so on with policymakers. But another, maybe even the main route in the long run, is that ERC-funded research results in, you know, academic publications and advancements in the field. And so when any existing science advisor or science advice institution anywhere in the world, but also in Europe, is looking at the literature because it needs to respond to a question from a policymaker of whatever form, the chances are that the relevant work you funded is going to come up anyway, is going to be there in what it finds. So in a way, you as the ERC don't enormously need to develop your own science advice capacities or even need to work to promote it, because it's already out there,
I would guess. Absolutely, and that is very true. I can give you just a very concrete example. Actually, one of our grantees is one of the most cited scientists in the recent IPCC report. IPCC, if I don't know if acronyms are allowed on the podcast, but, you know, of course, our grantees are, yes, they are cited, they are looked upon, they are contributing directly to deriving policy advice. What this agency does, or if I can say, or this body that implements the program, is not going to say this should be funded or that should be funded, or, you know, the other parts of Horizon Europe should, you know, invest money in this or that. But we can say, look, what ERC is covering today has advanced, you know, science in this field or in that field, and has made considerable contributions. And these are the contributions. These are the breakthroughs. These are the results. And please consider them in your reflections, or use that at least as an information basis for your reflections. And we also do give, for example, a lot of suggestions about grantees, ERC grantees that could participate as speakers or contributors to high-level also policy conferences or other scientific conferences. And so we do help and mediate, if you like, in those interactions. We are producing a report at the moment for a scientific opinion of the scientific advice mechanism. So yes, we are trying to ensure that what we do in this context of feedback to policy is actually taken up and useful for the policymakers' reflections. So that is indeed part of our goals.
Yeah. You mentioned foresight earlier on as one of these methodologies that the Commission is currently very much into that can be used to try and predict the future. And I guess one thing that can be used for is to try to decide what research we're going to need to deal with the future, and hence inform funding priorities. Now, I understand that your funding priorities don't use that, don't take foresight as an input, that's very clear. But it occurs to me perhaps your researchers' work, just because of where they are at the frontiers of science, might be generating foresight intelligence, as it were, as an output. By which I mean, can you look at the work your scientists are doing and pass that along to policymakers as something they should know about?
Yeah. You're right, Toby. And actually, so in our, again, to go back to how we thought about feedback to policy in our framework, in our context, foresight came up as an important area where we need to develop more capability. And actually, I do have a team member that has that expertise, and we hope to also develop more links as well with other foresight experts, not only the Commission, but also in other agencies like the European Innovation Council. I do think, as you say, we are in an advantageous position because, you know, everything that we fund sits precisely at the frontier of science and technological development. And so there's a breadth of information and knowledge that needs to be or can be exploited, can be looked into further. And so we will be doing that carefully and with small pilots. We really want to contribute to that, absolutely.
Another question. You mentioned that you contributed something to the scientific advice mechanism's work on sustainable food consumption. That suggests to me that you have quite some scientific expertise within your organization, not just in funding decisions and grant administration and so on, but also people who are able to answer questions like, what do you know about this specific topic?
Yes. Actually, that's another, I think, major asset of the agency that implements the program. And in fact, it has a scientific department with more than 200 scientific officers who have been themselves investigators, researchers, postdocs, some very senior academic experts, actually, in different fields. And I think that also sets us apart to a large extent from other parts of the Commission or other perhaps implementing bodies. There's been a special emphasis placed on recruiting experts with considerable knowledge of their respective fields. So that is a huge asset for us. And of course, my team is very small. And it works a little bit, if you like, as a funnel for, you know, organizing our input to the different requests and questions that we receive. But we alone in my team cannot address anything to everything, you know. We are working in close collaboration with all the scientific units in order to be able to channel that feedback I am a scientist myself, but I, you know, my background is mostly in life sciences. I mean, I've done many different things in life, but I cannot myself alone answer every single question that we receive in terms of what we fund in the ERC. So we rely heavily on our collaboration with our scientific experts in the agency. So that's in-house expertise. And in fact, this entire mapping classification of our portfolio is done in-house. So it's not at all, you know, externalized to consultants. So it's really, I think that's also what makes it very interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's clearly a strong benefit. But you also mentioned earlier in the conversation that you're keen not to duplicate what already exists, in which case, it seems to me that the more you develop this in-house scientific expertise, the more you acquire the ability to answer science questions based on a good understanding of the research that you oversee.
Yeah.
The more you do start to duplicate what exists in other science advice institutions, as opposed to, say, channeling your research into those institutions by recommending third-party experts or sending papers or whatever.
We are in, actually, we are. So let me just make some clarifications perhaps about how we work. We have this, what we call our feedback to policy framework, that describes basically how we want to develop that line of activity, yeah, and what it means for our program. And there are three main pillars, actually. The one is basically developing, as I said, this capability to build systematic portfolio analysis, so having the tools to be able to do the work. And the second part is, well, we have the stream on foresight, of course, which is also something very new for us, but we will not be doing alone. And certainly we won't be duplicating the foresight service of the commission. That's not the idea. And the second part actually is about planning a little bit ahead and anticipating. So we want to be able every year work on some reports on topics that we know there's interest for, and in the policy horizon, actually, these are the important topics that everyone is actually thinking about and reflecting about at the moment. So we are trying to do this kind of policy scan and propose on an annual basis two or three areas or topics that we know we will receive requests about. And there's been a lot of talk about how you anticipate, whether this is appropriate or not. But we want to anticipate, and mostly for planning and resources purposes, but also to make sure we give better quality feedback. And it's not only the commission that is interested in these areas and these reflections. So our main governing body, the Scientific Council themselves, are actually wondering about what we're funding in artificial intelligence, what's coming out of our projects that can be serious solutions or important solutions to be considering with respect to the green transition. What are we funding in terms of novel genetic technologies? They are themselves interested in looking at our data in a more critical and reflective manner in order to be able to say what we do on these different critical areas for society. So there's this interest from the Scientific Council as well, but also special focus on what are the actual breakthroughs that we produce. We should not be forgetting that, of course, one of our goals is to make the connection with the policy, but another equally important is also just shedding light on the intrinsic value of frontier research as such. So we're trying to combine the two. So I don't think we're duplicating anything. We're also approaching things from a slightly different angle. I mean, because the program is very different than the other parts of the framework. So I think there's value in itself by us doing that work anyhow.
Yeah. Well, listen, I feel privileged that I'm, as it were, in at the ground floor as you're setting up a new science for policy structure and within an organization like the ERC that previously hasn't focused on that at all. So I'm very grateful on behalf of our audience to you for sharing your experiences and good luck, obviously, with the new endeavors.
Well, thanks to you, Toby, for the opportunity, and I look forward to interacting more possibly in the future. Thanks a lot.
The Science for Policy podcast is created by SAPEA. It's produced by me, Toby Wardman, with additional research and support from Agnieszka Pietrzyk. CEPEA is a consortium of Europe's academy networks representing more than 100 academies, young academies and learned societies from more than 40 countries across Europe. We're part of the European Commission's scientific advice mechanism, and as such, we're funded by the European Union. Having said that, the opinions you hear on this podcast are those of the guests, and sometimes mine, but certainly not the views of the European Commission. This music is composed by Carlo Alfredo Piatti and performed by Elisaveta Sushchenko, and this last bit is particularly good.